We find animal behavior fascinating, and programs that we do on that topic are always very popular. And today we're going to come at it from a more theoretical and research angle than we often do. We're going to take a look at animal cognition today and whether animals are thinking in ways similar to how you and I think. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Patricia McConnell is a certified applied animal behaviorist, trainer, and author of many books. She's been a guest on the show many times, and we had our own show together for a long, long time. Always happy to have her with us. Patricia, great to see you, as always.
Oh, fun to be here, Larry.
And so today is a little different. So we'll not be talking about the usual kind of behavior thing. We're going to talk about animal cognition and how animals think. And I hope you'll join in. Do you think about whether your pets are thinking or not? Does that matter to you? Would it change the relationship with your pets or other animals if you knew to what extent they were actually thinking and reasoning things out? Kind of interesting stuff to think about. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. Patricia, what do we mean by cognition exactly?
Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, I asked my students at the university class, I said, okay, now we're going to talk about thinking and cognition, and I want you to think about thinking. What do you think you're doing when you're thinking? it all gets very circular, but cognition is another way of describing the mental life of a creature. And so one way to look at it is to divide it into a couple of categories that just sort of make it easier for us to talk about. We can think about the internal life of an animal as being partly emotional, so the emotions. So part of what you experience inside your head is based on emotions.
Yeah.
Part relates to consciousness. Are you conscious or not? And it turns out a lot of what goes on in our brains isn't actually conscious. It's sort of scary, actually.
Mm.
And then there's the part that a lot of people call thinking. Some people talk about that as cognition. It's the reasoning part. It's the strategizing part. It's the deciding what you're going to do tomorrow part. It's the making choice part. But all of those things, they're we can talk about them in categories as if they were separate, but you know, how life is. They're really not.
Yep.
They're really very closely related, but at least helps us, sort of gives us a start.
Well, in humans, there are a lot of different elements of thinking. Certainly language is a big part of that for us. How does it differ in animals?
We could just spend the whole hour, right? That's just a great question, Mueller. We really could, because let me just start by saying that for a long time, many, many people argued that non-human animals can't possibly think because you couldn't think without language. You know, you go back to Descartes. Descartes, I think, therefore I am, right? Descartes is the one who argued that animals weren't conscious, that you could do anything to them, and they were just sort of like a mechanical, I don't know, like an alarm clock or something. Mm-hmm. And so they had no consciousness, no emotions, and no ability to think. But it's now very, very clear that rationality, reasoning, and thinking is not correlated 100% with language. I think it's certainly true that our ability to use language has radically changed our ability to reason. Have you ever noticed how if you write something down, you know, you're trying to figure something out, you're sort of trying to sort it out in your brain, and if you write it down, it can get clear, or if you talk it out.
Yeah, talk it out.
That's a really simple example of how I think language has propelled us into a whole other category. But that doesn't mean you can't think without language. So it's now believed, there's so much research now on animals who don't have human language.
Mm-hmm.
And it should be pretty obvious that non-human animals don't have human language.
Mm-hmm.
But there's so much research now that shows animals reasoning, strategizing, et cetera, without language. So that's been dismissed by most. Not all, but by most.
Yeah. Well, you see a lot of articles about the thinking power of animals these days. And the understanding of that has really, really, as you're pointing out here, has really changed over the last 100 years.
Yeah, and you know what's fun about it to me is it's not linear. It hasn't all been one in direction. and unidirectional, and that we're like, oh, as we learn more, we understand more and more about how animals think. It hasn't been like that. It's been more like a roller coaster. If you go back to Darwin, Darwin was very comfortable talking about emotions in animals, about animals, some animals being able to strategize and being rational. If you go back even farther, I'm just thinking of like medieval France, where they actually, Larry, they actually would take animals to court and hold them morally and legally accountable for their actions.
Goodness.
There's a famous pig who was hung seriously because he got out of his pen and disrupted a cart, and the cart fell on the man, and the man died.
And so the
pig was tried for murder and hung guilty as charged in the belief that the pig could have done that intentionally. So then there was the 40s and 30s, and particularly in the States, when American behaviorists didn't say animals can't think or didn't say they don't have emotions, but said we can't study them scientifically. And somehow that sort of morphed into a belief that probably they can't think, and maybe they don't have emotions. And at least talking about it would be a terrible thing to do. You know how anthropomorphism was really a dirty word for when I was in school. Right?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
It was a dirty, dirty word. And actually, there's a lot of people now talking about Franz de Waal, famous primatologist, who talks about, well, there are different ways of being anthropomorphic. You can be anthropocentric and put us at the center of the universe and sort of miss that all animals are not strangely shaped people who can't speak. But then you can also be animal-centric, and you can put animals at the center and try and imagine their Umwelt, the world that they live in, their sensory system, how they see the world. And that's actually a very useful way of being anthropomorphic.
Yeah. He does a pretty good job of that in a lot of his writings, too.
Anybody who's interested in this topic, he's a chimpanzee researcher, Franz de Waal, W-A-A-L. Look him up. He's everywhere. He's internationally famous, and he's been here on the show, I think.
Yeah. Yes, he has. And we have callers on the line with questions for you. Patricia, you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org, or go to my Facebook page. You can post there at the Larry Mueller Show. John in La Crosse, thanks for calling. Hi.
I lived in the house. Never was allowed to get on the fridge. Never did get on the fridge.
Oh, you are completely breaking up, John, but I have an idea. I think I know. John has a dog. Knows it's not supposed to get on the couch.
Right.
But once they walk out the door,
dog's
on the couch.
Can we guess?
Dog's on the couch. So, and I'm hoping, John, this is, I'm pretty sure this is.
Call back if it's not.
It's
a common issue, so we're guessing that's what it is.
So he's wondering, did he plan that? Did he say, okay, as soon as they leave, I'm going to jump up on the couch?
Oh, yeah.
Does he think that out?
Yeah. Yes and no. Is he strategizing that consciously with exact same kind of thought process? We would not necessarily.
Okay.
Because it's actually possible. You can teach a single cell animal to learn, right? You can teach them a contingency. If a light comes on, you'll get an electric shock. So if the light comes on, leave the area, right?
Yeah.
You don't have to have a central nervous system to do that. So animals can learn contingencies and associations really easily, and they don't have to be conscious about them. A lot of what we humans do are based on that, and we're actually not conscious of it. And then later, it turns out, from new neurological work that we've done, we've discovered that you come up with a reason for doing something after your brain decides to do it. No kidding. It's sort of scary.
Yes.
It is. Most of what you do is basically based on your unconscious. And then your conscious brain comes up with a rationality for it. So back to the dog on the couch. Could he be thinking, I wish they'd go? Because as soon as he's going to go, I can get up on the couch. Very possibly. Are we sure that's the case? No. Because it's possible that he's, obviously it's simple to learn. If my human is here, he doesn't like it when I get on the couch. So I won't get on the couch when he's here. But when he's gone, he can't do anything. There's there's nothing to stop me from getting on the couch. So of course I'll get up on the couch. What I love are the dogs who, as the car is driving up, will like sneak off the couch, lie down somewhere, and like just because there's hair on the couch and it's warm doesn't mean I've actually been there.
Oh boy, Carolyn Milton, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. I need to start by thanking Sandy. We trained our last dog using the methods in her books, and she was by far the best dog we've ever had. So, thank you.
That's wonderful to hear. I think you meant Tricia. You said Sandy, but I think you meant Tricia.
I'm sorry. You know, I do mean Patricia. I'm sorry. I'm thinking of Sandy Sawchuk.
And I listen to Sandy all the time too. So I'm happy to be. Sandy.
We were just interacting with UW Madison because we had to put our dog down.
Oh.
But we've done research and we know what breed we're going to get, the same breed, and we have looked at some kennels that have excellent reputations. There's two different puppies, and we are we were told that we could have either one. We have to fly either way, so it doesn't matter. We would fly to pick up the puppy and then fly back with it. But from a cognitive perspective, one we could get at the end of September, and one we could get around the middle of December. And we want to do a lot with this dog. We're interested in agility, obedience. It's possible. I think in both cases, they told us we could have pick of the litter, and then we would be required to show the puppy. And so, you know, if you get a puppy in the middle of December, it's the environment's rather uninspiring.
Does that make a difference in cognitive development?
It's a great question. And boy, we could spend the whole rest of the day talking about that. The short answer is absolutely. There's a tremendous body of research that suggests that brain structure and function, you know, when puppies are born, their brains aren't done. When we're born, our brains are not done. Our brains, as it turns out, are never actually done. And they can change more than we ever thought. We just recently learned how malleable and plastic they are. But here's the deal. They're especially plastic and malleable during early development. And there is absolutely a correlation between structure and function of cognition, emotional reactivity, emotional stability, related to development. So here's what we know. We know that there's a range of sensory stimulation, a variety of sensory stimulation that young mammals need to get in order to develop to their maximum potential. Now, obviously, genetics are going to play a huge role. So
Sure. You
may have a puppy who is hardwired to be emotionally extremely stable, you know, and will love going out and about and doing all these wonderful things you want to do with it. Well, by the way, yay for you. That's really fun. Lucky, lucky puppy. And so we know the brain is a little more cooked right around the age of 5 months at a pup. But we also know that there's a critical period, or a sensitive period, they now call it, of social development is actually over between 12 and 14 weeks. But all of those early months, we know that within certain boundaries, dogs who have a secure attachment base, but also get a range of experiences, they go to lots of different places, they hear different things, they feel different things on their feet, they see different sounds, they smell different smells, tend to have less emotional reactivity and more emotional stability.
The more open minds almost?
They're less likely to freak out if you take them to a noisy agility trial. They're less likely to be afraid of strangers. They're less likely to panic at the vet's office. And there's also in other species, there's some really good work, especially in primates, that cognition, ability to think and process and learn, is higher in animals who've had a rich, sort of enriched developmental period.
Yeah.
So added on to the weather issue, which is a big issue here. Mm-hmm. You know, it's absolutely true that starting in December, fewer people come over. You don't get out and about as much. I think if the puppies were exactly the same, which they're not, mm-hmm. but if they were exactly the same, you would be absolutely better off to get the puppy earlier rather than later.
Yeah, there you go. Good luck. Thank you, Carol, for calling. Appreciate it. Talking today with Patricia McConnell, Certified Applied Animal Behaviorist, about animal cognition. Are animals thinking what we're thinking? That's what we're looking at. Larry Mueller here with Judith Sears Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, we're talking with Certified Applied Animal Behaviorist Patricia McConnell about how animals think. Patricia, how should we go about trying to compare our inner mental life with that of animals, or even should we?
Oh, I think we should. And I'm glad you asked, because some people probably don't. But I think there's so many reasons. You know, some are theoretical and philosophical. Like, who are we?
Yeah.
No? Mm-hmm. Who are we as a species? How do we fit into the rest of the world? And to some people, me included, that's a really important topic. And not just theoretically. I find it theoretically interesting. But we also know that a lot of research in human psychology shows that the more we feel connected to a bigger whole, the happier we are mm-hmm. and the healthier we are.
Sure.
So I think that's very important. It's also important in an applied sense, just in terms of how do we relate to the dog? You know, how do we relate to our cat? How do we have the best relationship we can with our horse? It relates to welfare issues and agriculture and laboratory animals. And so there's a vast range of importance, yeah. I think, in studying it. And so how do we do it? And the reason I think it's so fun right now is that the way it's being done right now is combining this great new high-tech ability to analyze brain processes, from fMRIs to CAT scans to all kinds of other procedures where you can watch brains working practically as they work. And a lot of that kind of research is what's informed us. Let me give you my, can I give you my favorite example?
Sure.
There's some researchers working with rats who trained rats to run a maze, right?
Yep.
Standard, been doing that for how long, right?
Yeah.
So the rats were trained to run a maze. While they were running the maze, though, they actually had tiny little electrodes in their brain. This was a somewhat intrusive study. They had little electrodes in their brain that recorded brain responses. So mm-hmm. whenever they turned left, some neurons would fire. When they turned right, some neurons would fire. When they mm-hmm. stop, et cetera, et cetera. So they basically mapped how their brain worked as it went through the maze. When the rats later that night were asleep, what mm-hmm. they discovered was during what looks like REM sleep, the rats ran the mazes.
Ah!
They actually ran the mazes. And not only did they run the mazes, they could actually go like in their heads. And exactly, in their heads while asleep. And they could, the researchers could actually say, yep, it's the third left turn. But here's the coolest part. In the maze, the rats every once in a while would stop. Like, you know. Probably deciding, what should I do? Should I go forward? Should I go, you know, should I go right or should I left? What should I do? They also stopped when they were dreaming. And the suggestion is they were thinking about what should I do? What should I do now? So one of the ways we do it is by all this great new technology. And the other is through lots of really great behavioral studies. There's a great crow study. They put a piece of food in a jar that a crow couldn't get at, gave it a string. string wouldn't work because, you know, you couldn't attach the string to the food. Gave it a straight piece of metal, soft, thin piece of metal. The crows bent a hook at the end of this piece of metal, picked it up on the other end with their beaks, and used it to fish the food out.
Wow.
So when you combine these great studies, biological, physiological studies, and this behavioral stuff, you can go a long way.
That is really
cool.
They're problem solvers. They can solve
there
problems.
There are a lot of animals who, you know, especially the corvids, the crows and the ravens, are the Einsteins of the bird world. But more and more we're finding animals solving problems we didn't think they could solve before.
I want to get back to the phones, and Carol, we'll get to you in just a minute. But one other thing here. Do you think in general people are comfortable with the idea of animals thinking?
Oh, and that's why or why not? Such a good question. Here's what I think about it. It's sort of circular, isn't it? Here's my take on that. I think some people are very uncomfortable with it, and I think it's partly the reason for a lot of the resistance that people have had about trying to understand the mental life of non-human animals. It makes things a little more complicated. You know, it makes our relationship with them a little bit more complicated. So I think for some people, it's distressing. And I think for other people, it's incredibly exciting and gratifying. It's sort of like the same reaction that people had when Darwin's theory of natural selection first came out. Theory not being a hypothesis, theory being an overarching explanation, right? That word has been so confused. I just can't not define it. So when he started talking about evolution and natural selection, some people found it fascinating, interesting, and exciting, and other people were appalled. The wife of Samuel Wilberforce, who was a great opponent of Darwin, said, "Oh my dear, let us hope it isn't true. But if it is true, let it not be generally known." Love that. One of my favorite. So British. I can say that. Anyway, so I think it's mixed, Larry.
Carl in Madison has a question for you, or a comment. Hi, Carl.
Howdy. Gads, I almost said Sandy. Patricia, I saw something on TV, and then I Googled it, and there's a foundation in Des Moines, Iowa that specializes in bonobos. Given that it's so close by, I was wondering if maybe you had been out there or if you know about it. There's one bonobo in particular there who has an incredible vocabulary and understanding of spoken language.
Yeah, Patricia, you're familiar with that.
I haven't been there.
Mm-hmm.
I have not been there. Do you remember the name? I can't think of it at the moment.
No, I don't.
Larry, can you think of it?
I can't
think
of it.
Yeah, none of us. Somebody, please get on Facebook and remind our old brains what the name of it is. There are quite a few organizations that take care of bonobos and chimpanzees. I think a lot of the listeners might know that NIH has just come out, very controversial, basically arguing that research on chimpanzees is no longer scientifically, it's not necessary enough to balance the ethics of it. So very controversial. But no, there's been some great work on language training in bonobos that I think a lot of readers know about. And Lana was a famous chimpanzee who learned sign language, which is way easier for them to, they can't vocalize like we can. But no, there are all kinds of examples of animals learning to communicate with us. One of my favorite is Alex the gray parrot, Irene Pepperberg's gray parrot, famous gray parrot who learned to use and speak because he's a parrot, right?
Mm-hmm.
Used to learn language very functionally, understood abstractions, really impressive stuff. But my favorite thing was when a particular trainer was working with him, they were being videotaped. He was tired. They kept going because they had the camera to borrow. And he was asked a question after question after question after question. He finally just said, "Go away." And I think probably why we love our dogs is that they can't look at us and say, go away.
Carl, thanks for calling. Vicki in Mount Horeb, your turn. Hi, Vicki.
Hello. I have a story that, to me, undoubtedly proves the emotional side of what animals can feel, but there has to be a cognitive element to it as well. Our daughter and her husband have an 8-year-old cat named Nestle, a neutered male, lived a very happy, sedate life with them in a condo in Indianapolis. And they found this kitten in a window well, abandoned, watched for a while to make sure that it was, took it in, and the two cats became very, very close. The older one really took care of the younger one, and they were very close. But my daughter and her husband really didn't want two cats in this small space. So we were going to take it, and they brought the cat from Indianapolis to Mount Horeb, and all was fine with the kitten, but their cat quit eating, would not eat anything. They took it to the vet. The vet said there was nothing physically wrong. He said, I think the cat is lonesome.
Yeah.
So I drove to Chicago. They drove to Chicago. We exchanged the kitten. They took the kitten back to Indianapolis. Their cat immediately started eating. The cats, they're now a two-cat family, needless to say. And they're doing beautifully with no further eating issues on Nestle's part. So, you know, it just the emotion that was shown there, I think, is amazing. And you just, it really makes me wonder what is going on in that little mind when something traumatic happens to them.
It's such a great story. First of all, thank you so much for sharing. And it brings up so many interesting issues. One is grieving. Can animals grieve? And the anecdotally, the evidence is just piling on. It's just coming out stronger and stronger and stronger. There's a group of horses in New Zealand who when one of the who lived in bands, basically a wild type existence. Mm-hmm. They're domesticated horses and well cared for, but they lived loose and basically formed social bands. And one of their band died, and the horses formed a ring. And this is not this is well established that it really happened. This is a very credible story. The horses formed a ring around this animal and just stood there for the entire day. Just for the entire day. I've had client after client after client who had a dog or a cat who appeared, who behaved exactly as a human does when they're grieving. Basically, one individual who they were attached to, whether it be another animal or a person. I had one tragic case of a dog whose the little boy died. And the dog, they came to me after a year because the dog still sat in the window waiting for the little, I mean, it's break your heart, waiting for the little boy to come back and hose. So do animals grieve? There's a lot of evidence that in many, many species, yes, they do. Now, I should quickly preface when I say animal, I should parenthetically say, you know, we talk about animals. Do cockroaches grieve? Well, probably not, you know. Yeah. So when we say animals, we often mean mammals and sometimes mammals and birds. So really, I should be talking about mammals. But so one, I don't think there's any question that particular, the older cat was missing the younger cat and grieving. The other thing it brings up that's really interesting is friendships between animals. It seems amazing to people who spend a lot of time with animals that would be controversial, but actually it has been in certain fields of science. It's been controversial about whether animals can actually form true friendships. There was an article in Time magazine last year that gave some of the new research that showed friendships in horses and friendships in dolphins and friendships in chimpanzees. But he actually concluded, I actually wrote him, actually concluded that there's no evidence that dogs can form friendships, and they probably can't. And you can just guess, Larry.
The steam just flew out of your ears.
Make a wild guess about by reaction. And, because it was just based, it was based on a misunderstanding or a lack of knowledge about dog social system. And if there's any mammal out there who's going to form friendships, it's a dog, biologically speaking.
And, you know, you gave me an example of it working the other way, that sometimes a dog can be happy.
Yes. Yeah. And that, you know, I'm so glad you said that, because sometimes animals are the opposite. Some they just have personalities that don't get along. It's the biggest factor in cats getting along, by the way, time and personalities. And one of the things that I think we need to pay more attention to is, do your dogs get along? And there's great friendships. I had two dogs who father and son, Luke and Lassie. And Luke and Lassie were, I mean, this was, oh, they were in love with each other. They adored each other. And when Luke died, Lassie was barely mobile. Yeah, she was distraught. She barely ate. She barely moved. When another one of my dogs died, Misty died, Lassie was so happy. So I think we need to be really thoughtful about dogs and friendships and, you know, I think dogs need dog friends, too, so which is a good reason to get your dog out and about if you just have one, but only with the right dog.
Jim in Milwaukee. Hi, thank you for calling.
Well, I was going to comment and try to expand it away from dogs into other species,
sure.
But you've already done that. But it's real clear to me, you know, through anecdotal evidence and experimentation, that, as you said, with corvids in particular, are are brilliant animals. But we're, you know, also things like cephalopods and dolphins. And I've even seen some films of cows that make me think twice about eating them. It's really quite amazing how well animals can think. You know, I've lived with dogs all my life, and I have no doubt that they think. I have a dog right now who's 5 years old that I've been teaching how to unravel himself from a pole when he's on leash and he gets tangled. And he's actually beginning to stop and look at the pole and his leash relative to it to know which way to go around the pole. And I've been teaching him that, to, you know, that one way or the other way. And he's actually beginning to pick up on it now. And now he actually looks at the pole first before he moves. And so it's very interesting that they can process and deduce.
There's so many things I love about your phone call. I don't even know where to start. One is I love your bringing in lots of other species because that's so important. Cephalopods, octopi, squid, a lot of the marine mammals, as we all know, are... appear to be extremely rational and really sort of high-level cognitive thinkers. There's even research that was done on pigeons that shows they can form categories. A category is, think about that, a category like tree. You know, when you say tree, we know that all kinds of different shapes, colors, et cetera, go into that category. So there's no such thing as the category of tree. It's a complete abstraction, right? Mm-hmm. Pigeons can, you can show them pictures of trees, of people, and of water. Totally different pictures, totally different trees, and teach them there's a category, tree-ness, and they get it. They can understand it, which suggests they can understand abstraction. So even pigeons are hardly known as the geniuses of the bird world. Can understand abstraction. So one, I love that you expanded the taxonomy because it's really important. And I also love that you talked about your dog wrapping itself around a pole because I actually use that as an example. I actually usually use that as an example of dogs may be much smarter than we think. There's much more going on in their heads than we often think. However, we have to remember this is an animal that once wrapped itself around a pole with a leash, can't figure out how to get out. So.
Well, now here's an example from Rod about an animal, a dog thinking. He writes about his sister-in-law telling stories of their two of their childhood pets. The mother decided to learn to drive. His mother. And after the father went to work, the mother would practice driving on their long country driveway. During the third practice, the family dog herded the three children up close to the back door of the home out of the danger of the mother's driving.
Oh, my goodness. Now, so here's my, as a woman, I just have to ask here, did the dog also herd the children away from the car when the man was driving?
Well, she may have been driving erratically as she was learning how to drive.
Well, she might have been. And that, you know, there's so many anecdotes like that. And some of them, when you really look at them carefully, it's like, you know, maybe that could be explained by something simpler. But awful lot of them really can't. And those kind of anecdotes are really important to build. To sort of generate good questions to ask scientifically.
Yeah. And Mike was talking about other types of animals, and Judith, our producer, saw a fascinating NOVA program the other night about cuttlefish.
Yeah.
And besides a lot of amazing
squid, right?
Yeah. Their scientists were studying them learning to go through a maze.
Oh, yeah. Oh, and that would be trivial. There's actually research on octopus in which they were trying to teach octopus basically something called learning to learn, which is that they were supposed to they were in a tank, the octopi, and they put down three things sort of on strings, and the octopus was supposed to pick the thing that was different. Two were the same and one was different.
Mm-hmm.
And so could the octopus learn the concept of same and different, another abstraction? And it turns out they could, but they weren't great at it. I'll just simplify it to that.
Right. Okay. Well, we have Gary in Marshfield. Gary, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I got a good example of a dog thinking when I was a young lad. I was walking with my two dogs along a lake, which is on the right, and they started chasing this rabbit, and the one dog kept chasing the rabbit, but but the other one made a sharp turn to the left because he saw the water, the bay of water, went over there. So he took a shortcut in it, and it really showed me that the dog can think.
Yeah.
And that's a really good point. I mean, basically what the dog had to do in that case was use its experience to think ahead, which is another kind of abstraction, right? You're not just reacting to the environment in front of you. To think ahead, what can I do to block that rabbit's future movements, etc.? And, you know, that's the kind of strategizing that wolves do in the wild when they're hunting as a pack. So, as you know, the best problem solvers often seem to be highly social animals, and that's a whole topic right there unto itself.
Oh, man. There's so much we can talk about here, and I'm trying to think about as we're getting close to the end. We haven't talked much about wild animals either in our relationship with wild animals and how what impact knowing how animals think or whether they think or not affects our...
Well, and I think that's a really important point. I mean, think about hunting whales, for example. You know, we now know that whales... give every appearance of being highly emotional, in sort of the best way, highly social, cognitive, rational thinkers, and so it does complicate things. You know, is this an animal really that if they're not necessary that we want to be hunting? You know, we also need to think about all kinds of things we do indirectly, like, you know, some of the sound programs of the Navy, for example, that has a profound effect, we think, possibly, on the welfare of other animals. And so, you know, the whole idea of the breadth of this line of inquiry really just sort of goes on and on and on and on. And it's very exciting and sometimes a little unnerving to some people, but I think it's going to lead to a lot of changes in our relationship with animals in the future.
And, you know, I want to mention your website and your blog because, you know, a lot of this gets you discuss a lot of this on your blog. I know that. And there's your books and so forth on the website.
Yeah,
and,
thanks.
So, and we have a link to your website. And it is?
It just go to patriciamcconnell.com. You can go right to the blog from the website. So patriciamcconnell.com. There's a reading room where a lot of articles I've written. And there's also the blog. We talk about cognitive issues and emotions quite a bit. So it's an international discussion.
Yeah,
sort of
well,
fun.
You get people from all over the world on
there
this blog.
There are 50,000 hits a month, and there are people all over the world. It's really fun.
So it's a fun place to go. So take a look. PatriciaMcConnell.com and click on, well, you'll see all the books, but then click on that blog too, because it really some fascinating conversation. Thank you, Patricia.
Oh, it's fun, Larry.
You'll come back. And
absolutely.
Appreciate it very much. Patricia McConnell, our guest today. Wasn't it fun? I bet a lot of us are going to be looking at our animals a little bit differently right now. Coming up next, Rick Cini of FairCompare.com is here with four hidden hassles of flying and what you can do to avoid them. That's coming up next year on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.